Well, I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News the fine photography feature, Tony Hewitt. Welcome, Tony.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you have taken some totally amazing photographs, and we'll start to look at them in a moment. But perhaps you could tell our podcast listeners the range of your experience as a professional photographer, as you are. You seem to me, looking at your magnificent CV, to have done it all, various forms.
I've been very blessed. I suppose the short version is that I walked into a church at the age of 26 to be a groomsman at my sister's wedding, and there was a very attractive female photographer who was photographing the wedding and who became my fiance a year later, my wife a year after that, and the mother of my daughter 9 months and one day after our wedding. So that's how I got into
photography. That's a story and you're sticking to it.
Her family were all photographers, her mother, her sister, both her brothers. Her father wasn't, he was a prison superintendent actually. But that was my into photography as a professional. I had always been a pretty keen amateur. Probably my most memorable amateur photo was being hung by the ankles on an offshore rig, the company will remain nameless, by a couple of my mates hidden behind tarpaulins, because obviously it wasn't supposed to be done, with an underwater camera taking pictures of the fish underneath. So I've always done that. Photographically, I shot just under 1,000 weddings, 987, so wow. I was 13 short of the 1,000, and then that got bumped up to 988 for a friend that I worked across from, and then a few years ago, I got a call from a very good friend of mine who runs a winery, and he said to me, "What are you doing on December the such and such later in the year?" And I said, "Oh, I don't know, Russell, you know why?" And he says, "You got a wedding to come to?" And I said, no. He says, "To shoot this wedding." And I don't do them anymore, you know. He goes, no, you're doing this one. I said, no. He said, "You promised Courtney when she was six." So that was my most recent wedding. Thousands and thousands of portraits.
So that'll leave 11 or 12 to go.
11 to go, but we'll see. I've got plenty of time left. I might squeeze them in yet. And then I also have shot thousands and thousands of family portraits. A big chunk of those were basically derivative from the weddings. So I'd shoot the weddings and I then moved into doing the families as they grew up. And in recent times, I'm kind of sheepishly say that I've done the odd grandchild of someone. So it's getting to that point. But that was 30 plus years ago. I joined the Australian Institute of Photography. I'm a fairly competitive beast at the best of times, but at the time it's more to drive myself. Parallel to that, I studied physics at uni, but didn't finish my degree, much to the chagrin of my father. However, I think over time he realised that maths and science also had an outlet through the arts. I was a musician when I was younger, DJed 500 weddings as well. So that was before I met my wife and became a photographer. So in the photography journey, I've moved through weddings, portraits, commercial, industrial, and then moved into delving into landscape. It was ironic that through the competitive part of the industry or through competition, I got a little bit jaded when people would say, "What do you do as a photographer?" And I'd say, "Oh, I'm a wedding photographer." "Oh, you're just a wedding photographer." And it was just almost like this, well, if you can't be a real photographer, go and shoot weddings. And I can tell you unequivocally that weddings are one of the hardest types of photography to do. With a background that involves a lot of people-orientated skills and things like that, weddings was a natural for me. And
it's such a big day for the people, and they'll be the harshest critics if you don't get them right.
Oh, that's right. And you're not there just as a craftsman. You're there as a psychologist, as an event planner, as a babysitter, a dress repairer, car driver.
Dress repairer?
Oh, I've had some
stories. Like a cricket umpire, you carry things in your coat.
I had it all. I had lipsticks and makeups and translucent powders and safety pins, and I've taken the bride to the church who was... The car broke down and we're running late, so...
Well, you're an absolutely indispensable person, Tony. I think I'd want to, if you were my mate, to always have you round about.
Well, part of it was due to the fact that I was trained by, you know, my wife was a photographer, her sister was a photographer, and her mother. So we would... And they were all shooting weddings. And at the end of a wedding, you'd sit back and everybody would, you know, debrief. When you had your photos come back, I was critiqued by my wife, my mother-in-law, and my sister-in-law. And who are also women. And
The ultimate quality control.
That's it. So over time, I really got to know, you know, if you pardon the pun, Mel Gibson's not the only one who got to know what women want. Well, at least when it came to the wedding. So, you know, that kind of gave me a good grounding, because a wedding, in terms of photography, weddings give you access to shooting landscape and jewellery and events and dresses and fashion and everything.
Yeah. Well, let me just start this discussion, or continue this discussion, by looking at a photograph. All your photographs are all going to be at random, I think. But look at this very first one here. Now, when the listeners to this podcast flick over to the gallery as they listen to you talk, they'll see this big turquoise, bluey, sea greeny coloured canvas with what looks like something that Jackson Pollock started but didn't quite finish. A whole lot of white stuff going on round about here in the middle. And what is it?
So what we're looking at is a distressed whale. I was running a one-on-one masterclass. I do a lot of coaching and mentoring. And I had a client from India, and it was a 12-day workshop, flying from Perth all the way up to Exmouth in a small Cessna, doing aerial photography. And on this day, we were due to fly out of Denham Airport and head east into the inner bays of Shark Bay. And at the airport, and one of the pilots had just landed from Shark Bay Aviation, and she said, "There's a whale in distress surrounded by a lot of sharks." So I said to my client, "I think it's worth us going that way," which is the opposite direction, "to see what we find." And we got out there, and this whale was surrounded by literally thousands of sharks. I've got images that you can see, not here, but where this sort of field of sharks goes on ad infinitum.
Goodness me.
Not far from Steep Point. So this whale was separated. There was three others out in the Steep Point opening, but this was inside the channel. And this was taken early in the morning. We actually went back later in the day, 8 hours later, and it was still going.
Oh, golly.
It's still fighting.
So that area was not named Sharks Bay.
This image, just this, that whale image, the interesting thing with that one is that it just this year picked up the wildlife category in one of the competitions in the UK, and it also won the nature category, and then it won the overall photography of the year category at that competition. So, and I was in London to receive that. So that's
in the days when you could be in London or other parts of the
world.
Yeah,
well, that was one of my last trips. Yeah,
Look, the very next slide I'm going to put up, I think, is an exhibition you might have running at the moment, is it?
Just closed. Transience is my fifth solo exhibition with Linton and Kay Galleries in Perth. Linton and Kay represent my work and have done now for nearly 10 years. So transience, the word transience, you know, impermanence, if you like, or nothing lasts forever. And this particular exhibition is almost, well, it's inspired by some of the artists in the pop culture world. I deliberately moved towards some vibrant colours in order to bring something into the world at a time when everything seems so grey.
When you look at the images that are just shown in that Transience exhibition slide, I get the impression there might be some aerial photographs there.
The entire exhibition is aerial, and in fact all my exhibitions with Linton and Kay have been aerial. So it's a little bit ironic. When I started in photography, every time I was pigeonholed, I'd change direction because I couldn't stand the idea of someone thinking they knew what I did. But nowadays I've realised that from a commercial fine art sense, it's good for people to have an understanding of what you're about. Having said that, the next exhibition does take a right angle turn. But yeah, they're all aerials. The thing is that's interesting is, firstly, when people look at them, the majority think they're paintings, not photographs.
Absolutely.
The second thing is they look at them and they think they've been all completely fabricated on Photoshop.
Yes.
And the reality is that all of the images in all my exhibitions are single shot. They're not composited or created out of multiple images. The colours are real, but like a conductor who might have an orchestra at their fingertips, I can choose whether I want the violin to be louder than the trombone, the drums to make a noise. So I accelerate or accentuate or turn the volume up on certain colours to help people understand what it was that I was intrinsically attracted to. So when I'm looking down, if it's the red that's really grabbing me,
yes,
I might bring the reds up and reduce the saturation of other colours. So I'm just, you know, the analogy I've used quite often is, in the Winter Olympics, there's a sport called curling.
Yes, love to watch the curling.
The stone.
Yes.
And the thing that fascinates me about that is they've got to move that stone, but they can't touch it. And that's very akin to, as an artist, wanting to direct the viewer's vision and thinking, but you can't physically make them do it. So
I love that analogy. Take this image here, which to me, just looking at it, tutored a little by what you've just said, see probably incorrectly what looks like, well, it does look like an oil or even a pastel painting. And this green yellow looks like sea, it looks like a red earth swamp. It could be the Dampier Peninsula or a broom or somewhere with the land margin going onto ground, but I don't know. Tell us what it is.
So Red Coast is the name of this image, and this is one of the images that formed the folio that won me the Australian Professional Photographer of the Year in 2013.
Congratulations.
Thank you. This image for me represents the yin and yang of the Australian landscape, where we have these beautiful, cool, primordial, you know, there's a swamp in the top left corner, almost a primordial million-year-old swamp, the origins of life type of thing.
Yes.
We've got these green cooling waters, and then we've got this vibrant, hot, red sand, almost a barrier protecting the primordial swamp from the ocean. The other thing is, a lot of my work, one of the things that attracts me the most is seeing the invisible and representing it.
How do you do that? How do you see the invisible?
Well, if you look at this, when we look at this image, you can very quickly see two things that are invisible. One is wind and one is current. The wind is represented by the fact that the red dust is blowing into the ocean or to the bay.
Yes.
And the current shows you the way it sweeps down the coast. So, you know, if you think of a picture of a, I'm a grandfather, I've got two grandsons. Do you have any yourself?
Yes, I do.
There you go. So I've got a photograph
four
of
granddaughters.
Four granddaughters. Keep your hands full. A picture of a grandfather standing, looking out to sea, holding the hands of a young boy. Now, most people look at that and say straight away, that's grandfather, grandson. So what is the pixel, what is the part of the picture that tells you they're related?
Mm.
And how do you know that there's an emotional connection?
Yes.
So things like emotion and love and romance, whether it's through weddings or portraits or family, intimacy, how do you see that?
Yes.
It's an invisible thing, and yet as photographers, street photographers often capture awe or fear or shame or guilt or happiness or joy or love. And we look at it and someone says, oh, look at that picture, it's full of, you know, joy. Which pixel is the joy pixel? Can I accelerate? Can I turn the volume up on the joy? Well, no, you can't. It's intrinsic. And that fascinates me.
But it is. Another thing about this is interesting. Aerial photography, and there's some more that we'll see. You're up, you're looking down, you're seeing the planet in a different way.
Yeah.
And you're interpreting it.
Well, it's shifting perspectives, and I've written a lot about shifting perspectives, that for me, I'm producing images that people could have been standing on the edge of that salt lake, on that coastline, on that beach, looking at this very scene. They may have done it many, many times in their life, but when seen from this angle, they probably don't even recognize it. Now, I think in the world today, it would be a better place if people took the opportunity to look at the things they've been looking at consistently, but with a deliberate shift in perspective. And often, you know, if we take a right angle viewpoint, we see something we didn't notice before and we understand it better.
Years ago, in the 90s, late 90s, I was in the East Kimberleys, and I had a big aerial map of that area, and I was talking to an old Aboriginal guy, and there were places he'd never been to, but because he did in a very traditional way know the landscape, he could read the aerial photographs, which were coloured and topographical, and describe places and things that he knew about from his cultural knowledge, but had never physically been there.
Mm.
Completely different perspective.
Well, spatial and spatial intelligence. You know, we talk about intelligence in people, and you know, historically, we grew up being told, you know, you're smart with maths or you're smart with English. And yet science tells us now there's 10, 11, 12, maybe more intelligences, with this natural intelligence, with people whose bodies know how to heal themselves a lot better than others. And spatial intelligence, which I know that I have a very good level of, and the ability like your friend, to be able to visualize in three-dimensional headspace what it looks like. When I fly, I can look across at something that's 10 kilometers away and look at the light and know that there's a shape on the ground, but as we get to the point where I can get my plan view, I know what it's going to look like before I get there. And I'll take people up in the plane and we'll be flying over. They go, why are we going over there? There's nothing there until we get there. This one, that one that you just passed, Geometry of Farming.
Here we are here.
This is called Geometry of Farming. This is from the previous exhibition. And flying over some farmlands, I saw these geometric shapes.
And
I started to go through this thought process that it reminded me of a protractor and a compass when I was a kid at school.
Well, the viewer's going to have to pause for a moment as you talk to realise that this isn't just some kid scratching around on a pad and trying to draw his
geometry
tools. It's not just a compass and a protractor and a couple of lines drawn. That is an aerial photograph.
Well, when you look at the bottom, you'll see that there's a sprinkler in that bottom left corner, and that's one of those circular sprinklers. And the thing that fascinated me was that, like the paddy farmers in Asia, there's a science, there's an exact science as to how to use the land.
Yes.
And we look at a farmer, and the last thing we attribute to them might be, you know, a high level of science or maths or ratios or statistical formula and all of that. And yet, they're using it all the time.
This as well is nearly monochrome. You get into it and realise it's not. And you start to realise from what you're saying that look at all of these paddock shapes or the topographical features, and then you get this little orange, vertical run here, and then you get these little patches of yellow. And you think, well, Tony must have just got out his brush and tinted those in. I mean, going back to your earlier comment, you presumably have just seen all of this before you take the photograph.
Yeah, so basically you've got a very dry, barren landscape. It's at the end of summer. It's very dried out. The sprinkler pattern or the sort of slightly dampish circle is where the sprinkler's been. The rest of it's still a bit dry. But there's red dirt on a track, which is the farmer's road coming into the tank where the sprinkler originates from. And there's some piles of yellow sand, and I just felt that in my expression of what I saw, I wanted to highlight these things.
Yes.
As I said, like a flute having a solo in a musical composition.
As we progress, tell us first, how did you progress from the wedding photographer to being well away from it, up in the air as far as you could go, and taking aerial shots?
Well, it's probably coming together of a lot of factors. One, my father's a pilot, so I was born in Malaysia, and I sat in the seat of a plane and steered a plane before I ever sat in the seat of a car.
And the viewers will notice you're standing next
to
a helicopter as well.
So I think I was always fascinated by or have a desire to grow. I'm always wanting to improve and become better at whatever it is I'm good at.
And changing directions as well.
Yeah, well, I'm not afraid of curiosity, and I'm quite happy to explore new things and take the skills I've learned and see how I can apply them in another area. Yeah. So aerial was probably a natural progression. It was part of a project I did with some other photographers and some of your listeners.
Tell us briefly about that project.
Well, the project that I probably kicked over, well, two things happened that got me ended up in fine art aerial. Number one, my wife bought me a hot air balloon ticket up in Northam. And I took a photograph up there, and it's still a very popular image. I think it's in here, I'll point it out later. And then secondly, about 2 years after that, a very, very close friend of mine, Christian Fletcher, who many of your listeners, anyone who knows photography in WA knows Christian Fletcher, said we're very close mates, and a couple of mates from the Eastern States who are top of their field as well. We were invited by Christian to form a working group for a company called Form, or a group called Form in Western Australia.
Yes, well done.
To photograph the Pilbara, to become part of a project called the Pilbara Project, which was designed to bring art to the Pilbara. And part of that project involved aerial. And we ended up doing 7 or 8 projects and multiple exhibitions and a couple of books. Mm. And that kind of gave me a taste of something I'd been delving in but never really taken seriously. So I've ended up where I have.
And a beautiful terrain, a beautiful place, the Pilbara.
The tapestry, Australia's landscape is world class, and Shark Bay itself is frequented by many of the world's best aerial photographers. They all look to come there to find what's there. And that project, we did one, there was the Pilbara, we then did one a couple of years later called Shark Bay 2016, which was used as one of the feature exhibitions at the 400 year celebrations of the Shark Bay landings. And that exhibition was purchased by the WA government and is permanently held up in Shark Bay now.
Fantastic. Mm. What's this one?
Ancient Echoes comes from my fourth exhibition, Lux. It is a sandbar in the just in Roebuck Bay, south of Broome.
Now, looking at this photograph, just so our viewers are looking at the right one, we've got, again, what colour blue is that around the edges of it?
It's almost a teal.
Almost a teal. And then what looks like it could be, well, anything with a line coming from diagonally from the bottom to the top. Almost looks like a map of Australia, but not quite. So
we were with a helicopter pilot. I was having a chat about the Kimberley area, the Broome area, and we're talking about the geological age of that area. It's one of the oldest parts of the planet in terms of the rock ages and things, and very big tides. And we're talking about the beating. We'd been talking about the heart of Australia, and we'd been talking about the heart of the Northwest. And as we were flying around, I looked down, and just in a flash, I just saw this sandbar in the late light where there was deeper blues in some of the shadowy areas, and the setting sun, the warmth of the light was hitting that lower area, which was facing that way. And I just saw a beating heart. And I looked down and I looked at the pilot and I said, "There's your beating heart of the Kimberley." And he smiled at me. I took the shot. And when I got back, as happens with a lot of my artwork, I looked at it and I felt that I wanted people to have a better chance of seeing the heart that I saw, so hence the blue blood, red blood feel. And Ancient Echoes is a reference to the beating heart of history, what's going on. Oran Fleurs from the last exhibition.
This one here?
Yeah.
Well, there's a certain abstractness to this that you just can't imagine someone dreaming up.
It's real.
So it's red at the bottom. It looks like some sort of vessels are draining downwards.
Oran Fleur is Latin for weeping gold. And this is part of the Hutt River Lagoon up at Lake Grigri, up just north of Geraldton, which has some incredibly beautiful pinks in that lake. We have a lot of pink lakes in Australia, made up of a mixture of, salt, various types of salt and algae interactions. So I just looked at this, and again, the beauty of aerial, particularly a plan view of aerial, is that there's no true north. There's no, you dictate what is up and what is down. And if you took a photograph of something from the ground as a elevated viewpoint, if you get the horizon off, people, the first thing they'll look at is go, "The horizon's wrong." And it throws them out. They're distracted from what the content is to the fact that you didn't get your camera straight. When you're shooting from the air, you dictate that, and you can create perceived horizons. You find lines, and if you place them as a horizontal parallel to the bottom of the frame, our mind's eye looks at that and thinks, well, that's the ground, and that must be above the ground sort of thing. And I use that technique a lot.
So are you always in a helicopter taking these shots, preferably in a helicopter, or do you use light planes? And either way, how do you... I'm assuming you don't have two mates holding you by your legs, dropping you down out of the plane to take these shots. How do you do it?
Yeah, definitely not. No. Well, so first of all, I don't use a drone. A lot of people walk in and think they're drone shots. So I've never taken a photograph seriously with a drone. I've played with them, but not. Helicopters and planes. Differences are helicopters are more expensive. Helicopters can be anywhere between $1,000 and $2,500 per hour. So it's not a cheap hobby. Planes are a little cheaper, $400 to $700. Planes can cover more distance and get there a little bit quicker sometimes, but planes are a little less flexible in turning around. If you miss something, you've got to go around a big arc. Helicopters can hold you on the spot. Contrary to what people think, you can't just hover on the spot and have a steady camera. When a helicopter hovers, it vibrates quite a lot. So you do need some movement. In terms of looking out, generally with helicopters, it's doors off. I never shoot through plexiglass or acrylics or glass. It's always clear view. But what you don't want to be doing is sticking the camera outside the slipstream of the fuselage, because any any air movement coming past will vibrate and cause camera shake. So you're actually sitting back in the aircraft, plane or helicopter, with an open view. So with a plane, sometimes doors off, more often it's windows up. In small planes, you can just lift the window up, and you, the pilot becomes an integral part of the process.
So does this mean the pilot's swiveling the helicopter?
Yeah, the pilot's tipping the plane over and things like that. So, I mean, it's always a bit of fun, and you've got to trust your pilot. I generally brief my pilots pretty well before I start, and I'll indicate that I'm going to ask for the stars, and if we can't go past the moon, you tell me, because I'm in your hands. So I'll keep asking you to tip over more, and when we can't tip over anymore, you tell me no. But I'm going to ask and trust that you won't take us past that point.
Yes.
I've had a couple of situations with some of the pilots. I've got some that I've worked with very, very often. And over southwest of flying over a pink lake, and I kept saying, wing down, a little bit more wing down. And then suddenly you hear this beep, which is the stall warning sign on a plane. And I sort of looked up, and he just looked at me. He says, "That's all good." He says, "Just telling us, the plane's telling us, we're no longer flying, we're falling. So if you can get your shot pretty quickly, we'll start flying again." But,
All right. Well, I'm going to bring us straight down to the ground now. You've unnerved me, Tony.
So it's always about making sure you've got your belt on, and it's a safe, there are safe practices. So
this is when Australia, I'm not sure whether they did make this themselves or not, but had an oil company called Ampol.
This is one of the key images of my career, I think. I was traveling around Australia. I always wanted to just go out and take pictures, and I worked out a way to do it where I was invited to speak in Tasmania, and I said to my wife at the time, our daughters were 11 and 15, no, sorry, 12 and 16, and they'd been coming to me with questions from school about, Australia and how big it was, etc. And I could tell they had no concept of how big our country was. And I got an invite to go to Wineglass Bay and speak at a conference. So I said, let's drive over and take the girls. That's one way to show them how big the country is. Mm. So long story short, we left Perth. I think we'd made it to Northam. And it's how much further to Melbourne, Dad,
How far to Wineglass?
Yeah, it's 4 days. And then we got a ferry across the bay. We spent four weeks together and took them over the Nullarbor and Melbourne and into Tasmania and did the talk, then spent some time there and up through Canberra to the War Museum and into Sydney and spent a few days there for my daughter's birthday. Anyway, when they flew back, I flew them back for school, and a mate of mine flew over from Perth on a red eye. So he landed at 6:05. My wife and daughters took off at 6 a.m., picked up my mate, and we spent 2 weeks driving back. And we just basically set ourselves a target of being in Perth 2 weeks after we left Sydney and travel west. We traveled along the Murray River, and at that time, there's a lot of the dead trees where the river was not only becoming too salty, but they were having problems at the time with fuel from jetties weeping into the water. And this is called resources. And there are five resources represented in this image. There is air, which you can see is represented by quite smoggy, dirty, polluted air. There are dead trees, and there is water. And none of those three resources are at their top health. And there are two other resources. One is oil, and one is gold, because it's Ampol gold. And oil and gold at the time I looked at, and the petrol bowser is almost a monolith, almost a like a statue that we would revere like a god. And I just had this is probably the start of me thinking as an artist and using photography. It was an image to me that represented that the fact that for so many people in the world, we're worshipping the wrong gods. Mm. In the background are air, sea and water, or air, water and plants.
All struggling.
Which are the things we need to survive. Mm. And in the foreground and proud and in the spotlight is oil and gold.
It glows, doesn't it?
I produced a 10-inch print. Yes. And I offered it for an auction at a resources conference raising money for children, and I often get asked to do it. So it was a 10-inch print on fine art paper. And the auction, it went for $10,000 as a print.
When was this?
And it was, this is going back.
I'm trying to work out how much $10,000 is worth
15,
today.
16 years ago.
Wow.
It was purchased, my understanding is, by an executive of an oil company. who I wonder to this day ever really understood what the true message was.
I was immediately wondering the same thing. There'll be others, if it's hanging proudly somewhere in Houston, the others will interpret it. But it just glows. That petrol Bowser, as we used to call them, looks like it's got its own life. It's about to move and talk.
And this is made up of multiple images. This is when digital was pretty new and I was playing around with compositing. You'll see some textures in the air. You'll also notice on the jetty, just in the front of the petrol Bowser, you'll see some shapes that almost look like the sides of drums and things. In order to get that petrol colour, I was photographing the same gentleman whose daughter's wedding I shot. This was going before she was even born. And, actually she would have been just young. Yeah, probably about 8 or 9. Anyway, I used to do some shots around the winery. And they were washing off the red wine around the vats on the floor, on the concrete. And it was shining with that reddish, watery colour. Mm. And I'd photographed it, and I was looking for something to give the petrol feel to this, and lo and behold, I come across this picture. I thought, that'll overlay and give me the petrol feel.
Just astonishing. Now, this would not appear, this next one, to be aerial, but it probably is.
Yeah, Brighton Blue, Brighton Beach, just south of Scarborough. Literally is just a picture of the coast with the sand tracks coming in from the main road, from West Coast Highway to the water. But symbolically, when you look at it from this point of view, you've got to remind yourself it's a plan view, because as an elevated view, it looks like the skin of the earth.
Yes.
The epidermis and what's the subcutaneous layers underneath it.
It does.
And then the sky and then the
like
deeper
that.
Space sort of skies above it.
There's a multimedia feel to it.
Yeah, it does. It's certainly got, it's certainly a lot of analogy in my work and symbology. And from an analogy point of view, this was part of an exhibition where I was exploring the separation between, or the places people go to escape reality. And if you think we live in a place where, most people on the coast work in the cities or, somewhere, many people work on the beach, but we go to the beach, and yet the beach, we go from these places that we work and live in, which are our everyday life. There's this very thin strip called the white sands of the beach for West Australian people, the culture, where we go and escape. But we don't go much further, because as we step off the beach into the water, we very quickly go into deeper and darker waters. And that represents a lot of fear. So this is this sort of safe haven between the everyday humdrum of life and the fears of the unknown, which are the deep water.
It's a very narrow strip, isn't it? It's
a very narrow strip. Yeah, very narrow
strip. And then we go to...
Chongqing in China.
Looks like Vincent van Gogh might have painted this.
Tale of Two Cities. If you look at the middle of the picture, slightly to the right, you'll see this older part of this city. And of course, right behind it is a modern metropolis. And to the left, you've got this bridge that's just beautifully designed.
And the colours are just stupendous. The warmth of those colours and what I just simply call purple and orange, yellow. It's just astonishing.
I was invited by a company out of Denmark, Phase One, which produced medium format cameras, who sponsored me. And I was invited to do a tour of China. So I did 7 cities. This is one of them. They promised me some times to do some shooting. So this was at midnight.
Uh-huh.
Went out and shot this. And this was part of a day where I got to present in a Maserati showroom. They sort of had Maserati and Phase One presents Tony Hewitt. Presenting to a room full of people with only one person or two people in the room understanding English is quite interesting. So through
a translator. Good to have a few images.
Through a translator, who was a very good translator. We got on really well. And trying to understand that, why did people laugh when I wasn't telling a joke? And then when I told a joke, I had all these stone faces looking at me like...
Australian humour is a terrible thing.
Well, particularly when it's lost in translation, I can tell you. But yeah, that was a fascinating... And this city is where the Yangtze and I forget the name of the other river come together. And you can literally see during the day the yellow river and the brown coming together. But to me, it represented modern cultures changing. Creative Live, I've done some stuff online. Creative Live is an online TV show in Seattle.
So it's got a beautiful setting. It's a studio, in effect.
It's a studio, and they run live. What they do is they'll have speakers in all sorts of creative areas come in. So we were in Seattle for a couple of days. We did 2 days of filming. People could watch it live, so you could actually literally watch it live. If you missed it, you could, and that was free. And then what happens is you can purchase the recording later and we get a royalty. It was great. I did it with a very close friend of mine, Peter Eastway, who's the gentleman I do some work in Middlehurst.
Now, as we've talked, it was really as well that you told us all how you started meeting a wedding photographer, marrying a wedding photographer, becoming a wedding photographer, being critiqued by wedding photographers. But then here we are in this amazing career you've had. You've been flown here, you've flown there, and you've been talking about speaking and presenting engagements. And I think you do a little of that.
I do a lot of that.
More than a little of that.
I do a lot of that.
What got you into that? And what are you doing when you present? Why have they got you there?
Okay, so back probably in the mid-90s, I'd won several awards. I won the WA Photographer of the Year after a couple of years in the industry. And they, I was asked to host the WA State Awards. And I, with a whole, you know, 5 years of 500 weddings behind me as a DJ, I'd done a lot of that. In fact, I grew up as the oldest child of an oldest child, so I've always been put in that area of responsibility where you're in charge, look after everybody.
I promise I'll behave.
And consequently, I was invited to speak. I picked up an award between Australia and New Zealand as this sort of best print across Australia and New Zealand. And that got me a trip to New Zealand as part of that, where I was asked to speak, and I was asked back again. And then from there, I was asked to host awards. I've done 19 Australian Professional Photography Awards presentation evenings. So that'll be the Crown or you know, somewhere in Darling Harbour each year. Been doing that for a long time, but I've also hosted conferences here and overseas. It's just a natural progression, I think. I'm comfortable on stage, I'm comfortable speaking.
Is there a multimedia aspect? I'm leading up to a question, Tony.
Yeah,
says,
sure.
What's your favourite music?
I'm quite diverse with my music, to be totally honest. Yes. I'm a Billy Joel, Eagles, America type fan.
Oh, well, we can keep talking.
But I can also appreciate, you know, James Blunt, and I can appreciate, you know, a lot of the modern stuff. I probably don't get into trash metal and I don't get into heavy rap.
Yeah.
But...
Yeah. I like the use of the word
classical.
Appreciate.
Yeah.
But I'll stick with the Eagles.
So presenting and hosting is something that even now in the next 2 weeks I'm talking to a camera club next Monday night. Tonight I'm actually chairing a judging for the Australian Online Awards. I've just had to say thank you, but no thank you, to the New Zealand Institute to be a part of their judging process. In two weeks' time, I'm hosting a two-day live program for a photography conference, which will have people from all over the world. And then 4 days after that, I'm hosting the Australian Online Awards presentation here in Perth.
We're going to let, because the conversation's too interesting and the time becomes a factor in our discussion, let our podcast listeners and viewers look at a number of these aerial photographs. They're just beautiful. I'm looking at one here which looks like the end or beginning of a river, which is yellow and beautiful greens and shades of... But tell us, where is this?
This is in the Northern Territory, Gulf of Capricorn. Gulf of Capricorn. This is part of a massive project, the biggest fine art project I've been involved in.
Yes.
And it was also... I think it would be fair to say it's the biggest fine art aerial project ever done in Australia, possibly one of the biggest in the world, where myself and a colleague, Dennis Glennon, flew around Australia in a Cessna, 31 days,
yes.
164 hours of flying,
yes.
And took 84,000 pictures and produced an exhibition of 100 prints, which then was opened in Sydney by Honourable Julie Bishop at the time.
Is this one of them?
Yep, it's another one.
Next one,
that's just near Derby.
That is astonishing. You describe it to the viewers.
To me, why this became the hero image of the project.
Yes.
Because to me, I see the wings. I see a wing.
I see the wing too.
And for me, we were blessed. We travelled on the wings of angels. You know, when you travel that far, 31 days, 8 hours a day in a very small plane, there was so many things that had to go right. The timing we did, we skipped storms. We flew out in the middle of thunderstorms and found our way through them. We skirted cyclones and, you know, we had no issues. We're blessed. We saw many, many things. I mean, it would be a monthly podcast for the rest of my life, which may end up happening. But this is the red dirt that's left when the 8 to 10 meter tides off Derby in the northwest of WA.
Yes, absolutely.
As the tides go away, you get these big mud areas with all sorts of abstract patterns.
But the whole composition, the colour, the way you've represented the cliffs and that red earth and sort of geological formations, parts of it tell you it might be a painting, but if it's not a painting, you struggle with a photograph. It looks like a realist painting. It is just magnificent.
I think one of the things I've learned over 30 years in the industry now is that what I did as a child has been the foundation for the way I see. I was in my leaving, I was a 97% for maths in my leaving exams. I was a 95% for physics and things. So I look down, you have your basic rules. You have your rule of thirds that people know, and then you have more complicated algorithms, Fibonacci numbers and all of these things. But I think there's instinct as well. And I look at things and I just have an instinct for balance visually.
Well, you've got a creative spirit, obviously. Very
certainly curious,
real.
But there's always a sense of balance. I look at something and I can see, it's not just balance in terms of the obvious shapes, it's balance in terms of colour, in terms of direction of where are my eyes going? Is it being held in the frame? Is it being taken out of the frame? So,
serious people become seriously involved in photography. What is it, Tony, for you, or what you've drawn from other people's expressions that draws us to photography, that makes photography what it is today and keeps it as an obviously highly sustainable art form?
I think some of it comes down to the fact that we go through our lives talking to each other and sharing our experiences, and without maybe often realizing, so many times we'll share an experience with somebody who was there and they come back with a different interpretation. And it's almost like we're looking at, but you were standing next to me. Why didn't you see what I saw? I mean, husbands and wives will know exactly what I'm talking about. Partners will know exactly what I'm talking about. We've had these discussions. They keep seeing it different. I think photography is a chance to sort of show people what you mean when you say, hey, this is what I experienced. Whereas they'll say, well, hey, isn't that interesting? Because I was standing next to you, but I saw something completely different. The image that you're looking at now was...
This is beautiful. We have a humanoid.
We do. I shot a portrait and I've done a lot of fashion. This is a daughter of a friend of mine on the Great Barrier Reef on a conference. Again, I was hosting a conference. I was part of the conference. I was one of the speakers. I was also shooting at the time for Nikon. I've shot for Canon as well over the years. But... I was asked to look after her. She was turning 18, or she'd just turned 18 that day, I think, or the day before. And her mum and dad weren't coming on the catamaran out of Airlie Beach out to the Barrier Reef. And I was asked to do a demonstration with a very, very long lens. So it was I think it was a 600 or an 800 mil lens.
Goodness
me. So to do that, we stopped at a little sand cay in the middle of nowhere, 50 kilometres offshore, and she was my model, Kashifa.
How far away from you?
Well, she's probably 60 metres away. So if you think of some of the stories over time with people in the Barrier Reef, I naively at the time went out into the water up to my chest on the Great Barrier Reef in the middle of nowhere. We had about 30 photographers on one end of a sand cay, literally 70 metres long. So they're at one end, almost comically looked like it was going to sink on that end. And at the other end was this beautiful 18-year-old woman with this scarf blowing in the wind that I photographed.
Just a scarf. It's superb. And the shape of it, the way it caught that, is unbelievable. Tony, you...
That's the aerial shot from the balloon. That was probably
the
first aerial
shot. This is the aerial
shot
from the balloon we had to find. That once again, I was brought up in a family of watercolourist artists, and the use of the colours, the paint, with the running water where you create things blurring into the other. It reminds me very much of that style.
Well, one of the tricks, one of the challenges as a photographic artist is finding narratives and being able to express them. So this image here, I think why it works is if you cover the right-hand side of the picture and look at the left-hand side, you'll find a very cold palette, which is reminiscent of the early mornings, the fog. And you can see the fog rolling in on the left.
Yes, you can.
If you cover the left-hand side and look at the right, you'll see the warmth of the day.
Oh, you do.
And you'll see the sun breaking through and clearing the clouds. And if you look at the bottom half of the picture, you'll see the middle of the day, the trees that anchor that central part of the picture, and it becomes a like in a clockwise direction, this sort of the cycle of a day from morning to during the early morning, the daytime, and then we drift back into night.
Tony, are there particular pathways where photography is going? I mean, plainly, people keep taking photographs of weddings and people keep taking magnificent aerial photographs and of people on streets and everything else, but are there some new forms of photography that you can imagine? Yeah.
There's a lot of, I mean, you look at what's being done with Instagram and people, you know, we'll come back to that one because that's probably, actually, if you go back, I'll do it now, that's part of what I'm talking about. Obviously, that's me.
Yes.
And that's my oldest grandson. And when we talk about photography, people explore it and use it as a form of expression, use it as a form of art, as a form of record, documentation, event record. But for me nowadays, it's equally as part a way to leave behind something for my, you know, family to know who I was.
Yeah.
And for my grandchildren and great-grandchildren to know who I was. And this reminds me of, you know, in particularly that I should make sure I use my skills and my talents for those closest to me as much as I use it for everybody
that's
else.
Really lovely. Yeah, that's sort of related to a question that I've often wondered about, and I think a good number of people have with digital photography and the world the way it is. How do we store things for future generations?
Yeah, making sure that you realise that sitting on your computer is not a safe place. So make sure you've got it in multiple places and print.
Print
on good papers. All my artwork is printed on a beautiful rag paper from Canson, which is a French paper.
Yes.
It's archival, pigment inks, and it'll last.
Fashion. This is fashion.
This is fashion. So I
looks like it's somewhere out in
well,
the
ironically,
in some desert or somewhere.
Phase One asked me to be one of the two photographers in the world that photographed and launched one of their new pieces of equipment, which was built around high colour. They said, we can do anything you want, we'll pay for you to go anywhere you want, do whatever you want, but you can't do aerial photography. And I looked at them and said, you're kidding, that's me. And they said, no, we've got another guy who I know and a buyer, is a guy called Timo Lieber. He'd done some aerial over Antarctica. Can you do something else? Would you do fashion? We've seen you've done some in the past. So this is, some of the stuff I did.
Fascinating.
Portraiture. A
bit more of it?
Yeah. Well, that was a different shoot altogether. Salt Lake Blue came out of the ND5 projects, the Pilbara project stuff and Shark Bay.
I love the geometry in that.
Scarborough was a very popular image, but it's very literal. Presenting on stage, that was pretty much a female conference, really, and I was asked to speak using my photography.
Now, like Steve Jobs, do you have a uniform when you present? Is this it?
Funny you say that, because just in this conference coming up that I'm hosting in a couple of weeks, they've asked me to be very thoughtful about what I wear, but yeah, I hadn't really gone there. This was about 500 women in an audience and maybe two blokes. It was a children's portrait.
Now, you've mentioned underwater photography earlier. Do you do much underwater photography?
Only for, more for fun. Yes. I'd like to go there. I was a diving instructor when I was younger, so yes. I certainly, it's kind of like I've got to go there. This is my wife. This is an image I put together from 13 different images to represent and for her to have something symbolic of her solo Rottnest swims. She's done four or five solo swims to Rotto as part of the Channel Swim, but she's also one of the few ladies to have done a double crossing to raise money for SIDS.
Yes.
She raised about $75,000 for SIDS doing that.
Now, here's a highly, if I can say so, sort of stylized photograph with the cloud, the brooding sky, the shadowed sand in the foreground, and then everything highlights the waves breaking. And
this image is called The Wave, and it's one of my first panoramic, done for art to hang on a wall type of images. Three frames in a whole day of thunderstorms and dark clouds. There was a break in the cloud and light came through. Again, for me, images that have some analogy, some narrative, some emotional symbology is what's going to really hold my attention and mean something to me. Silver linings.
It takes me back to your earlier comment. I think it was the beach near Scarborough.
Yep.
Where you pointed out that we go to the beach really to get the feeling that this photograph conveys. We go there for peace and harmony and to deal with our worries and to calm down in many ways.
I mean, where's photography going? You asked me a moment ago.
Yes, tell us.
You know, where's photography going? Well, I think that image there we might come back to because very quickly, it's a very important one. But where's photography going in a nutshell? For me, people say professional photography was dying, and I think photography's exploded. Every person on the planet is a photographer.
Yes.
And I think what photography's allowing us to do and people are doing is to say, you know, we see the world in different ways. Let's stop thinking that what one of us sees is what everyone sees. Let's start realizing that everything is an interpretation and celebrate it. It's as simple as that. And some of us will do it with 2 meter prints, like say what I do with my artwork on a wall. And some of us will be using a phone, and that's all we'll ever do is use a phone. I've got some friends who are vloggers and bloggers, and they just use their phone to share their experience of the world. That's where photography is going. It's going everywhere.
And I suppose what photographs like you do, for people like me and others who will be listening and looking at all of this, is that you realise that some of us, you in particular, have this tremendous capacity to take shots we can only dream of, and from positions too, places where we will never be.
Perspective.
Yes.
The traveller on the beach in Venice Beach in LA. I had a few days off.
I was going to guess the Gobi Desert or somewhere. It was Venice Beach.
No, it was a misty day, so that's actually looking out to the horizon, the ocean, but you can't see it because it's a very fine mist. I saw this gentleman walking along the beach towards me. I kept the camera at my hip. There was something about it which I didn't understand until I'd taken it. He didn't look up at me at all. I never spoke to him. We never connected. I didn't need to. He didn't look at me, so he's not recognisable. But I saw myself. I saw a lot of us. I saw people walking with the world on their shoulders and looking down and never stopping to look up.
He looks burdened, doesn't he?
He does. And I looked and I saw how the tracks behind him are there for all to see. But the reality is, no matter what part of your journey you're on, when you look at that, there's no steps, no footprints in front of him. Yet to take them.
Just needed to Photoshop the Hearst Mansion in there somewhere.
So that was, for me, very symbolic of travelling through
that,
life.
Is that monochrome?
It's
not.
It was a very flat, muted light.
Yes.
And I just kept, it's in the same way that nowadays I often turn the volume up on the colour, in order to be complementary to the message and the emotion,
yes,
I've turned the colour saturation down a little bit. So it's very muted. In the same way that if someone gets excited, they yell and scream and talk loudly, where at other times they'll get very quiet and passive.
Yes.
It's still speaking. It's the same words. It can be the same sentence, but it carries a different feeling. As a photographer, I choose to use photography skills and techniques to modulate and moderate the message.
To interpret what you've seen. And do you ever go black and white?
I've got black and white images.
When do you choose to do that?
I think the image tells me what it needs. The image will tell me what should come next. I'm just trying to know if I put some black and whites in there. Is there any black and whites? I probably didn't, although there might have been one back earlier that is a colour version of one that I decided in the end to do black and white. Colour is a language.
Yes.
As is contrast, as is sharpness. So I think when I choose to use black and white, it's where the texture and the tone and the shapes are going to carry the message more than the colour. You know, red is a passion colour. Oranges and yellows can be a passion colour. Greens and blues are quite calming. So if that's not the way I'm going to tell the story, if it's going to be through texture, there's so many images I could have used to explain this, then that's when I might decide that colour's not part of what I'm using. You know, you take a song and you hear the recording done by the artist, and then you hear another version of it where they go unplugged, they have no drums, you know, or it might just be a guitar. So they don't use all the instruments, they just use one. Mm. Still a great song, and it's a different feeling to it.
Yeah. Tony, to finish this delightful discussion, we have something here that the artist Charles Blackman, I think, could have produce. What's happening here? It is just a lovely.
It's a simple light in the ceiling, looking down. There's a painting behind the bride.
Oh,
and
yes.
You can see a cross, which is the is actually in the painting, but it looks like a window.
Yes.
We're about to walk into the reception. She was just pushing her veil away, and it was a very symbolic image of weddings. And I just snapped it at the time. It's quite an old image.
It's a very beautiful one.
But it still stands the test of time.
To get from your wedding photographer.
And I think when you look through the selection I gave you, which is quite varied, simplicity and minimalism are quite strong, and symbology. And I've learnt that when it comes to photography and people out there taking pictures, less is better. leave what you need to leave, or try to keep it as simple as possible to make it easier for people to understand what it was you connected with and what was resonating for you, rather than try and include everything. And having a bit of space around the main subject is not a bad thing. People often feel like they've got to crop right into it to show us, this is what I want you to see. Well, that's fine, but you get the benefit as the photographer of context. Sometimes it's good to give me that benefit as well to help understand why you found that thing that you're photographing and sharing important.
Tony, this has been a complete delight. And indeed, it is something I think you do occasionally, that is give masterclasses about photography.
I do a lot of that. I coach, I mentor, I've got people from Europe, Asia and America that I speak to regularly. In fact, from here I'm going to coach a lady I've been working with for 4 years. I run a mastermind group every year where we have a maximum of 5 or 6 people, and they work with me for 9 months on personal projects, and some of them are artists, some of them do books, some of it's more of a personal journey. And I'm available for, you know, I do camera club work and things like that. So,
well, in the written introduction to the podcast, the readers will see more of what you just said and more detail about your career. And but thank you very much for joining me today and sharing some of it with us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, Michael. Thank you for having me.